The recording for started.
Thank you very much. Welcome everyone to this CCWG accountability meeting. I note that we have lost the count now for the number of meetings. Maybe it's a better choice not to count them anymore. And as we reconvene after the Marrakesh sequence, I think we'll start with the administrative matters. And I'd like to ask if anyone is on audio only at this point.
Hi, Mathieu. This is Keith Drazik. I'm on audio only at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. You're added to the roll call. Anyone else?
Jordan Carter here. I'm on audio only for about 10, 15 minutes.
Excellent. I note that Barak Otieno also is on audio only. That's noted. And anyone else? No one else. If there is any statements of interest? I am noting none. So let's get back to work. It's been quite a little while since Marrakesh. And actually, as we reconvene, we're still following closely after the successful outcome of this Marrakesh meeting for our group. And the momentum we had in Marrakesh has carried us into very fruitful collaborative working sessions amongst the lawyers. And we've been presented it was on Sunday for many of us, maybe not all of us, a very high-quality document, which is an outstanding achievement considering the amount of changes to the bylaws that had to be taken into account with both the CWG and the CCWG report. And I think we should really recognize the extraordinary amount of effort that has been carried out by the legal teams. They've been able to deliver on time based on the very aggressive timeline we had defined. And we have a very high quality document. So I don't think we could expect any better place to be now than what we have. I wasn't placing the expectation any higher than that when we discussed last time in Marrakesh. Top priority tonight is going to be to answer the questions that have been raised by the lawyers, because answering those questions really is the critical path at this time. I think it's worth noting that these questions are mostly seeking clarity on our intent, and that's why I think it's really top priority to clarify this. We have 34 questions for both reports. Not all of them are for us as a group, but it's quite a limited number considering the breadth, the variety of our recommendations, and the complexity of the work that we've been undertaking for almost 2 years now on those recommendations. So I think we should, as a group, once again acknowledge the quality of the work from the lawyers, and also take this rather limited number of questions as a good sign for the quality of our work in terms of clarifying where we are. That would be my only opening remarks, and maybe we can just step into the item number two, because I'm seeing Holly Gregory's hand up, and I was about to turn to you, Holly, for an update on the work to date to give us a flavor of what has happened and where you are at this point. And I think that will certainly help kickstart this meeting right away. So Holly, please take the floor.
Well, thank you very much. And it's great to be having this opportunity to talk with you all with a solid draft in front of us. As you know, ICANN Legal took a shot at drafting a first rough draft, and then we had a face-to-face in LA for 3 days, really 4 days, We were lucky to have Becky Burr and Krista Spain with us to help work through some of the issues, and we also had the help of the Bylaws Coordinating Group, who we had a number of calls with to go over open issues along the order of the kinds of issues that are on the agenda for today. Post-LA, we entered another very intense week where we shared drafting back and forth between ICANN Legal and Sidley and Adler at an extremely intense pace. As you know, it's a very lengthy document. There are a number of sections. We did them section by section, article by article. And I have to just call out to the team I know at ICANN Legal, at Adler, and here at Sidley, there were a number of members of the team who pulled more than one all-nighter. It was really an all-hands-on-deck effort. I'm very appreciative of the cooperation and goodwill between ICANN Legal and the Sidley and Adler teams and the commitment to working through the issues together. We don't agree on all issues, but we really were committed to trying to understand the viewpoints and working together. And I think the draft that you have before you reflects that commitment and that goodwill. The draft is a work in progress. I just want to make it really clear. We haven't certified it, not because we don't think it's in line with the proposal. We think, of course, that it's in line with the proposal. But as you know, there are some open issues, and we need your additional input on those issues. And also, frankly, we need some time to review the document. In just looking at it over the last 20 minutes before the call, I found two little sections that somehow didn't make it into the draft. So we're doing what we call a rules check. We're going through the proposal line by line, ticking and tying to see that everything is reflected in that draft. That takes time to do. We did that on the rough draft, and it helped us organize our thoughts for that discussion, and we're doing it now so that we can be prepared to certify. We've provided you with a mapping document that shows where in the bylaws the various items of the proposal are. Kind of a rough map. We did it overnight last night and haven't had a chance to check it all, nor do we think that it's really a good use of our time right now. I think it gives you a general sense, and I think you'll be able to find things. The tight time frame is our biggest challenge. But I want to emphasize that we expect that we will be able to certify the draft, but we need to make sure that we've identified the nits and closed the open areas. So with that, if there isn't something else that you'd like to do, we can go into the questions. So I'm going to turn it back to you, Marcel.
Thank you very much, Holly. Cavus signaled in the chat he had a point of order. Cavus?
Matthew. Before you're going to the presentation, you need to have approval of the agenda. This is an ordinary arrangement at every meeting. We don't have approval of the agenda yet because I want to talk about the working methods. Last night, we have CWG. We spent 1 hour and 25 minutes listening to the lawyers explaining what it is on the paper before. So we don't want to spend 1.5 hours for presentations. This is number one, and I have a statement to make once you deal with this matter. Please provide us with the working methods, how you want to do this work, how much time you want to give to the lawyers to present the things. We know they have done a good job. We really appreciate the work, but we would like to know how you proceed. And I have a statement to make with respect to the testimony that made before the subcommittee of the House. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. I don't think we've ever, in any of the CCWG meetings, formally done any approval of the agendas. However, I note your comments on the agenda, and certainly your point on the subcommittee will come back to you in any other business. I think it's certainly something that can be addressed at that item of the agenda. Regarding the use of time, our intent today is to take questions by questions and provide as clear answers as possible so that the lawyers can keep working. It is not our intent to have a lengthy presentations by anyone. I think a good use of everyone's time is making sure we understand the questions, provide the clear directions for the lawyers. And I think that's what we try to explain. So I think that should be consistent with your expectation that we don't give anyone undue bandwidth in the limited time we have in this meeting. And I think Holly gave an excellent and clear and concise summary of where we are, which sets up nicely into our timeline and next steps. And maybe what Thomas is going to address in the next agenda item is going to respond to part of your questions. Thomas, would you like to introduce the timeline and the way we are planning to approach things on the bylaws certification?
I'm more than happy to do that, Mathieu. If staff could please bring up that slide with the timeline, that would be appreciated. And while we're waiting for the slide to be uploaded into the remote participation room, let me also use the opportunity to welcome all of you back to our calls. I hope you haven't missed us or each other too badly. Let me also use the opportunity to congratulate all the legal teams for an incredible piece of work. You know, Rome hasn't been built in a day, but you've almost rebuilt ICANN in a matter of a fortnight. That's really remarkable. And I think we, even though the document is not yet on, I think we should all respect a sequence of happenings that's going to take place over the next couple of days and months in order to get organized. We do know that some of you have spotted issues in the bylaws that they want to discuss. There will be time for that. We have basically four phases in the work to come, and we're now in the first phase, and we would like us all to focus on that first phase. And this first phase deals with responding to the lawyer's questions or the legal team's questions, because these seem to be the issues that they need to get clarification on first with highest priority so that they can get closer to finalizing the draft and certifying it. So even though you might really feel the need to make points that you've identified, please hold that back. Let's go through the questions asked by the lawyers one by one, and let's try to get through that exercise as quickly as possible to complete what I've called phase one. Phase two is going to be working on the issues that you have identified in addition to what we've heard from the lawyers. And we will then, as a leadership team, try to provide answers to you where we can. So you might identify issues where we have an easy answer, but in cases where we can't offer a satisfactory response, we will take your concern back to the legal team so that they can take a look at it and see whether your point needs some refinement of the draft bylaws. And that's the exercise that you find in the second bullet point. After that, hopefully the lawyers will be, or the legal teams, I should say, will be in a position to finalize and certify the draft. And that is going to be phase three, where you're going to get an opportunity to look at the draft and provide feedback to the certified draft. And then finally, there will be a fourth phase where the ICANN board is going to put out the bylaws for public comment, and you can certainly chime in during the public comment period to make yourself heard with any questions or concerns that you might have. So this is roughly the schedule of work that we have in front of us. I'm not going to read out the slides and the dates to you because you see them on the slides in front of you or on the slide in front of you. And while you're going through that, I see that Kavus's hand is raised. I think that's a new hand, so Kavus, the floor is yours.
Yes, it is Newham. Thank you very much, Thomas.
Hello, this is Sean. I'd like to stay on the queue.
Can I talk?
Yes, and Sean will be in the queue after you, Kevin.
Yes. Thank you very much for your explanation. And sincere and profound millions times of thanks to lawyers that they have worked around the clock. That has been said. I suggest that lawyers, they put the question up, explain them one by one, but not all together. After each question, seeking some preliminary comment to the questions, and then getting these comments, we come back at the next meeting or at the end of this meeting, if possible, to the questions whether we could have a firm reply to that, which I believe it is not possible. We had the same cases of exercise last night, CWG, and the entire period we just discussed. There were some comments, but no conclusion was made with respect to some of the questions, but very few of them had the firm reply. So I suggest, if you agree, we take the questions one by one, a pause, and asking comments, and gathering comments, and then based on that, if we are able to give a reply now on a consensus basis, so far so good. If not, we have to sleep on that and come back to that at later stage. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Caboose. And before we move to Sean, let me briefly respond to what you said. It's almost like you were reading our minds, because when we prepared for this call, we chose to suggest to the group to go about with this almost exactly as you just stated. We're going to go through the questions one by one. So we're going to have, we're not going to mix them or have a presentation of several questions at once before we ask for comments. So you can expect us to go through the questions one by one, and we're going to, or we have certainly tried to identify an answer for the group already. So we're going to suggest what we think might be an appropriate answer, so that we can hopefully truncate the discussion with the group and ask you to confirm whether our solution, our clarification, is the one that is shared by the whole group. And I think that we will be able to quickly identify uncontroversial points, which we can tick off the list vis-a-vis those points that might need more debate, and we can get back to those at a later point. But rest assured that that we will give the group the opportunity to chime in, and that we will try to make it as easy as possible for everyone to follow the conversation, because it's quite challenging to look at such a lengthy document and such a quite long list of questions. And the other good news is that we will not need to look at the draft bylaw language today. We're just focusing on the questions, because we can discuss them in isolation, and I think that will make it easier for the group to follow, and also to form a view on what feedback we should give to the legal teams. Sean, the floor is yours.
Yeah, this is Sean. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Jonathan. I just wanted to say that for the sake of the remote participants, during the presentation of the phases, it would have been good to also hear if there are specific days assigned to each of the phases. You were saying phase one, phase two, I didn't hear how long each of the phases were going to take, because I'm audio only. The second point is in relation to what you just responded to, Carlos. I just want to get the process straight. Can I assume that the responses we make to these comments now will be sent back to the mailing list? I will be given certain time. It will be good to know the time to actually get final feedback before it's actually certified as the formal response to the legal team. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. We will certainly send the feedback that we've been working on to the list for everyone's review before anything is passed on to the legal teams. So unless there are more questions on the timeline and the approach, I suggest that we dive straight into responding to the questions or working on the answers. And the first couple of questions are going to be dealt with by Mathieu. So Mathieu, over to you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. We will put in the AC room the document titled issue list that was circulated. I think we can, yes, we can all zoom in a little bit. And what we're planning to do is to introduce the question shortly, go to ensure with the rappers and the lawyers that we have captured the essence of the question correctly, and then try and answer. So question number one is a bit long in the document. I will not read everything, but it's basically about the words the root zone in the mission. So it's Annex 5 in our report. And our report mentioned that I can coordinate the allocation and assignment of names in the root zone of the domain name system. And it was noted that the root zone of just did not appear in the existing bylaws and was not defined. And so the question was whether to define this term or remove the words. And maybe I could ask Becky whether there's any extra context to provide to that.
Well, to keep clear, I think it's exactly what you said. You know, the contracts with registries and registrars have to do with second-level registrations, and the current bylaws don't limit it to the root zone. So none of us could recall precisely where that language came from.
Okay. And so, Becky, what would be your recommendation to this group? Do you think it would be consistent with the intent of the report if these words were removed, or do you think defining it is better?
No, I am comfortable with the definition given the limitations in the mission that follow.
I'm not sure I understood exactly what options you were comfortable with, Becky. I'm sorry, I'm a bit slow.
I am comfortable with removing the words, yes.
Okay. Would anyone have comments on that or concerns about this? As we said, we've shown it. It's not a final answer we're giving now, so we still have time to think about it. But obviously, if anyone has immediate reactions, it's going to be most welcome. Kevin?
Yes, I have one general comment, and I have a specific answer to this. First of all, we are talking about bylaws. You can make any changes that you want, but if we face any difficulty in future to change that bylaw, there is a very complex procedure. So, would it not be possible that if it is not absolutely necessary, we do not go to the level of details and put the things in a very high level and general manner? I said, unless it is absolutely necessary. You can do whatever you want now within this time, but once it is there and we find the problems and we tidying up our hand, if you want to change it, there is a very complex procedure. So let us, when there is a changes, see that whether we could maintain whatever is proposed to be in a general term, high level, and putting a sort of the latitude for further further implementation, or if it is very, very necessary, like CWG last night, then we need to clearly specify the situations he specified that. This is one. Second, still I'm not sure what Betty proposed. He says that removing what? There are two proposals. One is in the recommendation 5, the other proposed by the lawyers. Which one Becky is
suggesting to use the phrase, the sentence that is closest to the existing bylaw and which does not mention the words the root zone. And I think the argument is close to the one you were using, Caboose, that we need to stay on the safe side and limit our changes to the strict necessary because of the potential and intended consequences. So I think that's going in the same direction as what you seem to say in your general comment. I'm seeing some traction in the chat for how sensible it is to remove this. So I think we can use this as our assumption, our draft answer at this point for question one, and move to the next question, which is question two. Question two is also on the mission, and it's related to the GTLD registry agreements discussions we've had. There was a note to drafters in our report in Annex 5 that is that the lawyers attempted to translate. And one thing, there's actually two sub-questions. One is to confirm that existing GTLD registry and registrar agreements should not be subject to challenge as outside of mission just because they have expired and have been renewed pursuant to the renewal provisions that are part of those agreements. And the second sub-question is to confirm that the new form GTLD registry and registrar agreements would receive the same grandfathering treatment, but only for the terms and conditions of the new agreements that were contained in the pre-existing agreements. So, Becky, maybe it's worth explaining a little bit why this question was raised and what your recommendation is here.
Yeah, so this is actually a complicated issue. I apologize for it. What we said in the report is that the provisions of the existing registrar accreditation agreement and the registry agreement would be immune from challenge on the basis of the language, would be grandfathered until they were replaced by another form of agreement. Now, that works reasonably well in the registrar accreditation agreement context, where registrars have the option of going to a new form of agreement which becomes available. The same is not true for registry agreements. Those automatically renew on their term for 10-year periods of time. The difficulty is that the sense of the group was that we were not grandfathering the provisions of the existing agreement permanently forever after, and we certainly don't want to create a way in which this can be gamed. But the simple fact of the matter is that right now ICANN has an obligation to agree to renew the contracts by their terms. So there is a bit of a disconnect between what we were trying to do and the actual manner in which the contracts themselves work out. And since we cannot, as part of our process, modify the registry agreement and the registrar accreditation agreement, I think that we have a somewhat inelegant solution, which is to use the language that's provided here, but then have the registries and registrars and negotiate potential changes in the context of, for example, further expansion.
Thank you very much, Becky. So your recommendation would be to confirm both of the sub-questions here in the light of the reality of the contract.
I'd like to hear from Holly and Rosemary if they've had any further thoughts. We've been wrestling this to the ground fairly recently, and I wonder if there any other solution has emerged.
Okay, so maybe I go to Caboose and Alan, and then back to Holly if you want, Holly. Caboose?
Matthew, I don't have any problem if you could put some clarity, but do you remember how many hours we discussed this grandfathering when on joke or reality I said, why not grandmothering? How much time we have spent? What I heard from Becky that for one, grandfathering could apply, for the other does not apply, if I understood correctly. But the issue of grandfathering was very important, that whatever agreement is already in place should be continued without being considered that they are outside the mission until they are renewed. Now, Becky wants to separate registries from registrars, if I understood correctly. I have difficulty that one person at this stage or one or two from the lawyers proposing something which the group discussed for hours and hours and hours. So if there is a proposal, that proposal in a very clear language, not in a question two, which is very complex, to put a clear options for further discussions at a later stage. So I am not comfortable with the answer given by Becky. I'm very sorry, I don't understand that. Grandfathering must continue to be applied. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. I think Becky is stating in the chat that she was not implying that they would be treated differently, but certainly we need to get some clarity here. Alan.
Thank you. I guess I am also asking for clarity, because although I heard the words Becky used, I got really confused towards the end. What I'm trying to understand is what with the current intent right now, when a contract expires after 10 years and there is no desire from ICANN to change the terms, for instance, associated with voluntary picks, even if they are outside of the mission, will they continue or will they not? I guess I'd like to have a simple answer to that.
So
my understanding when we put the words together was the grandfathering would continue past renewal. Otherwise, we're suddenly in a position where 8 years from now, the terms of a contract are going to change, and perhaps the terms associated with how the registry was granted its TLD. So, this is
Becky,
very
would you like to clarify right away?
Yes, I would. Look, guys, there's no confusion at all. The notion is that the current terms and conditions would continue to be in full force and effect and could be renewed. However, the report, and that includes voluntary picks, so if ICANN never changes the form of agreement, then they're renewed. But if, for example, there is an updated registrar accreditation agreement, or there is a revised registry agreement associated with a new round of GTLDs, the report contemplates that existing registries and registrars could move over to the new forms. That works for registrars. It doesn't work for registries, because of the way the registry agreement is structured. So Alan, the answer to your question is, for so long as those forms of contract remain the forms that ICANN uses, and they are not replaced or substituted. They are grandfathered.
Thank you, Becky. Robin.
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you okay.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, so I actually am concerned about extending the grandfathering to renewals of existing agreements, because it seems to me that sort of circumvents the whole point of having the mission limitations. I think that it's fair to say that we agreed that existing obligations with respect to things that could be considered outside the mission would be out of scope, but I don't think that it's fair to say that we went so far as to say all renewals, because that just sort of is an exception that really swallows up the whole rule in terms of trying to put some kind of mission limitations on what ICANN can do. So I think it goes too far to include the renewals in the grandfathering clauses. Thanks.
Could I just respond quickly to that?
Yes, very quickly, and I'll try to close the queue after Greg Chatton.
Okay, I just want to be very, very clear. The language says that this means that parties who entered into existing contracts intended and intend to be bound by those agreements. It means that until the expiration date of any contract, any such contract following ICANN's approval of a new or substitute form of registry agreement or registrar accreditation agreement, that is in the report the language that we use to describe the length of grandfathering. So it clearly includes renewals, and I think it says that specifically, that it includes renewals until such time as ICANN approves a substitute or replacement registry or registrar accreditation agreement. So, Robin, I just want to be really clear that we're trying to be faithful to the language in the report.
Thanks. And maybe Rosemary will add a few of the latest thoughts on that in the lawyers team.
Sure. So there are basically three categories of agreements, I would say. There's agreements that are either in existence or shortly to come into existence. There are agreements that are not, you know, there's a form out there, but there's no negotiation or there's no counterparty at this moment. And then there's in the future when there's a new form. So those are the three buckets. The problem I see with the proposal language, and I think there's a sense in which the proposal language did not anticipate, that both the registry and registrar agreements have provisions regarding renewal that doesn't allow ICANN to impose on the counterparty a new form, even once a new form is in place. In the case of the registry agreements, they can't do it at all. I mean, there's no provision for a new form at all in the agreement. In the registrar agreements, there is a provision for a new form, but it's at the option of the registrar. If we put in place bylaws that require ICANN to impose terms, we are essentially requiring ICANN to breach the renewal terms of both registry and registrar agreements. And that, I think, would spark an avalanche of lawsuits potentially if people didn't like it. So I don't think that will work. So given what the existing agreements say, and by existing I'm also including everything that's kind of in process now, you're stuck with essentially permanent grandfathering because you can never force them onto the new form under the way those agreements are now. Now, some of the registrars may opt for a new form when one's available, but we can't force them. So I don't think we have a lot of choice with respect to that first bucket. And obviously, with respect to the last bucket, the new form, who knows what that's going to say, and we can certainly put in appropriate renewal provisions so that future new forms would also be able to, you know, which obviously the new forms are, I assume, subject to extensive community discussion and transparency and process. So those are things that we would maybe feel comfortable requiring counterparties to live with the possibility that a new form could come down after, you know, when their contract renews. What that leaves is the middle bucket. These are agreements that have not yet even begun to be discussed, right? So there's no counterparty yet. It's just in theory. We've got a form, and we've got people out there who might someday want to use that form, and we have no new form. During that period, right now, anyone who comes in 6 months and says, I want one of these agreements, is going to be using the existing form. But the existing form has this provision in it for renewals. So once you sign, even though it's not even in negotiation now, if in a year you sign something, ICANN, sign something on the new form, it will then have to be grandfathered forever, just like the stuff in the first bucket, the bucket of existing agreements. As far as I know, the only way to change that would be to make a change in the renewal provisions of the RAs and RAAs, and I don't know whether that's even something we can discuss. I just don't understand how that happens, how new forms happen.
Thanks, Rosemary, for highlighting that. Basically, our choices are a little bit constrained here. Caboose, your second round in this discussion, and then I'll close after Greg.
Yes, my second round. I'm sorry, we are opening a new idea. What some people said, it was discussed at length during the CCWG. The only thing with respect to the issue is first grandfathering concept. It is to be accepted. The second is the lifetime of grandfathering. One option which is embedded already is at the end of the contract. You could add something if everybody agrees, a consensus saying that up to the end of the agreement, and you add unless otherwise specified and approved at later stage. That means you leave this open. Matthew, we are not going to settle all the problems of the world now. There is an ICANN continues, and we don't talk about new DTLD. We could leave with that. So let us make the minimum changes. If you could add something unless otherwise specified, would be valid until the end of the agreement. This is one suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. Good suggestion. Greg?
Thanks, Greg Chatton, for the record. I actually think this strikes pretty much the right balance in terms of what's being grandfathered. More specifically, I think that renewals should be part of the grandfathering. We're talking about the same agreement. And the idea that when we roll over to a new agreement, recognizing there are complexities and fit issues here, but conceptually, when we're coming around to using a different set of terms, you know, that's when the grandfathering should stop. At that point, there'll be, you know, a whole serious set of reconsideration of issues at that point. But should not have agreements that are essentially going from acceptable to unacceptable on their terms solely due to the passage of time. Related issue is making it clear that we're talking about essentially going to a new set of terms and not just any modest revision. If there's a change to or an amendment to an agreement or a change to one provision of an agreement, that should not extinguish the grandfathering. That's essentially the agreement is continuing on its terms at that point and should remain within the grandfathering. Otherwise, we end up, I think, with a bunch of of very odd things, which is where an agreement that's been in place, for instance, for any number of years, is suddenly challengeable solely because it was renewed, solely because of the passage of time, and not because, now there's a whole new agreement in front. Thanks. I think we should avoid that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Craig. So my interim conclusion on that would be that certainly it's a matter where we've discussed, we have spent a very important amount of time, so we need to proceed with caution. We sort of have an inclination into confirming both questions, but by next meeting on Thursday, we will try and provide a more substantial and argued argument about why we inclined it this way so that the whole group can make sure we're all in line. So we have a good candidate for an answer, and we'll confirm on Thursday. Question number three is related to reconsideration requests. So we're going on to recommendation number eight. And there's a proposal in our report that says that recordings and transcripts should be posted of the substantive board discussions at the option of the requester. And there have been concerns between during the drafting that this may add substantial burden and expense without commensurate benefits, I'm quoting here. And also concerns about some legal aspects like breaching laws, contractual obligations, and so on. So the lawyers were providing a provision to be considered that is slightly adjusting our requirement, and which is that if the party seeking reconsideration requests, the board posts either a recording or a transcript, and the board shall decide between recording and transcript, and the board may only redact the portion of the record that reflects privileged advice from legal counsel or includes icon trade secrets or for which it's if disclosed, it would breach a binding contractual obligation or legal requirement, et cetera, et cetera. So I think... maybe I will go to you, Becky, for a quick word whether that's, that provision is the one that you would be suggesting.
Yes, Matthew.
Okay. And I'm seeing I don't know if Greg, that's an old hand or a new hand. Old. So, Ed Morris. Welcome, Ed. Ed, if you're speaking, I cannot hear you. Ed, still nothing. So I suggest that we move to the next speaker while Ed's sound is being sorted out, and the next would be Cavus.
Matthew, I think there is a difference between the recording and the transcripts. I have read several transcripts, and I saw sometimes there are differences in the way that they have been assembled. Secondly, we are transferring the burden from ICANN to thousands of the people requested. Why not put it in an option that on the request of the requester, whoever is party, you provide either of the two, otherwise you provide both. If there is no specific request, you provide both. But if there is a specific request that I'm happy with the transcription, you provide transcription, or I'm happy with the recording, because the difference is a lot for some people to download the recording and so on and so forth. So they may need both. So why we transfer the burden from ICANN to all other people? So can we make something is more latitude that depending on the request. Otherwise, provide both. So default would be providing both, unless it is specifically requested either of the two. Thank you.
Sorry, going off mute. Thank you very much, Cavus. So you would be in favor of slightly adjusting this provision. Ed is now back on audio, apparently. Ed? Still not hearing any.
This works
yeah, that's
now?
Good. Now it's working.
Sorry, guys. And thanks, Becky, and everyone who put this together. When I first read this issue, my first reaction was, you have to be kidding me. We do recordings and transcripts of subgroups of subgroups of subgroups of supporting organizations, of stakeholder groups in supporting organizations. There's not a huge administrative burden here. We need the transcript in case the requesting party wants to take this matter further. We need the recording in order to ensure the accuracy of the transcript. In terms of the redaction categories, they look reasonable. But I'd remind everybody that the defined conditions of non-disclosure of the DIDP look reasonable, too. There's 12 of them. And at least some of us believe that the staff and board have used those maybe to avoid releasing information that should be released. So what I would suggest, if we're going to go down this path, and I do agree that there is a reasonable cause at times for redacting information, there needs to be a prescribed appeals mechanism, fast-track, free of charge to the requester. We can't put the board in the position of deciding what information is released or not released without providing the requesting party some sort of appeals to make sure this is done in the spirit in which it's intended. Thanks.
Thanks, Ed. Robin?
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Robin.
Okay. So I actually didn't have a problem with ICANN wanting to provide either a transcript or a recording. I think that as long as one is provided, that can people who are present can check against their own memory, then that's probably sufficient, and I can live with that. And I think it's reasonable for there to be a list of categories of things that for which the transparency requirements don't apply. However, I'm a little bit concerned that this list is a little bit too broad and a little too sort of subject to only the discretion of ICANN and its lawyers, you know, what they want to consider privileged information, what they want to consider trade secret, things like that, I think, can just be very broadly categorized and then barred from the transparency requirements. And, you know, these are the kind of categories we see currently in the DIDP request denials. So, you know, there's a precedent for abusing these kinds of categories. And so I think we may want to just narrow in a little bit more on these categories to make them just a little bit and not entirely at the discretion of ICANN's lawyers and an opportunity to easily abuse the transparency requirements that we've otherwise baked into the reconsideration request process. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Anand, Cavus, and then we'll try to wrap up this question. Anand?
Thank you very much. I have no concern in theory. I have a real concern in practice about saying only transcripts, in that the transcripts we often see are loaded with man, woman, and not always getting that right, unintelligible in brackets around whole sentences, and just blatant incorrect transcription in others. So if all we're going to get is a transcript which might be loaded with those kind of things, it's close to a useless document. Thank you.
Thank you, Anand. Cavus?
Matthew, I would like to draw your kind attention of everybody, that the document that we are going to modify was gone through three public comments, and it was gone through the chartering organization and approved by the ICANN. unless we have a good reason, we cannot change it just because of the wish or because of the legal view of somebody. However, in order to have some clarity, we need to maintain the envelope of the initial proposal as approved on 10th of March, but we should further clarify that in order to make it easier for the people. And I agree also with Alan that transcribe or transcription, sometimes there are a lot of difficulties and problems, and we don't blame anybody. So I would suggest once again that we leave it at the requester to select between either of the two. However, unless otherwise requested, both should be available just for food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. I had closed the queue, but Christopher's intervention would be the first in this meeting, so I'm prepared to make a small exception for you, Christopher.
Thank you. Very, very briefly, I think the staff should write proper minutes of these meetings. The transcripts are not very useful. I think Alan has made that point. And the recordings, well, if I don't have time to go to a conference call, it is probable that I don't have time to listen to the whole of the recording either. I really think that things could be made much more simple and transparent if we had minutes of the meetings rather than relying on so-called transparency of transcripts and recordings. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. I think this is an item where we are going to need some time to think about the various comments we've received. It's clear to me that we have a very direct and straightforward answer to the question at this point. It's certainly a small deviation from the report, so it's certainly natural. I think we'll try and come back by the next meeting with some form of proposal that tries to take into account the various inputs we've received. I'm not 100% sure we can make everyone happy here, but certainly it's a new issue, new question we hadn't considered in the report, obviously, since it's a change from it. So we'll have to come back to that question. Number four is related to the review teams. Maybe I will just turn to Steve DeBianco, who was leading the effort on the AOC reviews, to give us a flavor very shortly of the question and propose his way to see the answer. Steve, on the question four.
Thanks, Matthew. Question four gets to the idea that in the affirmation of commitment to reviews that are brought into the bylaws, how explicit should the bylaws be versus referring to some external document called operating standards for details? We had a back and forth with a couple of board members and with ICANN Legal in late last year on this, and concluded that we needed to reflect what the CCWG report contained. And there could also, in parallel, be operating standards at some point, but we didn't want to lose any of the requirements that CCWG came up with. And I think that the legal teams working together came very close to satisfying the ability to do both. But I have three points in suggesting how we respond to question four. And question four asks, are the changes on operating standards acceptable? The first thing I'll note is that it does feel acceptable that the draft bylaws say that operating standards will be developed with the global internet community for the conduct of reviews under this section. It goes on to say that operating standards have to be aligned with the following guidelines. And then they list the guidelines, almost verbatim, that were approved by the CCWG for the purposes of how review teams are composed. If you recall, it was up to 21 members. The process by which the chairs of the ACs and SOs could make the assignments. So far, so good. So I think on that respect, we're in good shape. Then, number two, the operating standards are also cited in Section 4683, and that regards how a review team would make its decisions. And they didn't indicate in the draft bylaws that there was a requirement to align with what we said in the CCWG final report, which was, that in the event that a consensus cannot be found among review team members, a majority vote of the members may be taken, and that all of the majority and minority responses would be included in the final report. So that's in our paragraph 58 of Annex 9, but it didn't make its way into the draft bylaws. It's interesting to maybe take a cue on that, whether members of the CCWG think that we need the bylaws to reflect how a review team goes to majority vote if it can't make consensus, or leave the bylaws silent on that with the assumption that either the review team itself would determine its decision-making methods, or the community would eventually come up with operating standards for how review teams make those kind of decisions. So, Matthew, I could defer to you to see if anybody has a reaction to that. My personal reaction is I think we can leave it alone. We can let the review teams determine it or get operating standards someday to address that. But I just wanted to faithfully report whether the bylaws actually reflected what we had in the report. And then I have only one small item to finish with, the third of the three items on this question. Matthew?
Thanks, Steve. And I think your suggestion is on the safe side into taking what is in our report and only what is in our report. Ed, I don't know if it's an old hand or a new hand. So we have, of course, Caboose?
Yes, I have no problem to take whatever you have in the report. But the bylaw or bylaw is the highest level of the legal text. If there are some cases that you could in the operating standards, approval or modification of that does not have the same formalities of the bylaw, why not take that? But I have serious difficulty with the last suggestion of Steve that when we don't reach consensus, we go to the majority. We had this discussion yesterday in the CWG, and I oppose to that. It is up to the team or the convener to seek the consensus, and we don't define consensus. It is not only GAC issue that say consensus means approval of everybody without any formal consensus has various meaning, various types, and so on and so forth. Draft consensus and so on and so forth. So we don't want to change from consensus to simple majority. And Steve, even yesterday we discussed that, and we don't agree with that. Steve, I'm sorry, I can't agree with that. Thank you.
Well, Steve will answer, but I think Steve agrees with you in terms of what we write in the bylaw, Steve.
Yeah, here's the thing, Caboose. Our job is to match up the draft bylaws with what the final report said. And as I just indicated, the final report in paragraph 58 of Annex 9 says, and we approve this, in the event a consensus cannot be found among the members of a review team, a majority vote of the members may be taken. So we said that in our report, Caboose, and I'm trying to align us to the report. If we leave that out of the bylaws, you have two implications, that either the review team determines it on its own, and we don't know what they'll determine, or the community eventually develops an operating standard that would define how a review team reaches its decisions. So under those cases, we don't know what the outcome will be. But if we wanted to maintain absolute fidelity to what we approved, we would have to insert the words that in any event a consensus cannot be found, a majority vote of the members may be taken. I am comfortable leaving those words out on the assumption that the review team or eventually the community will do operating standards. So you're sort of off base because I'm not debating what's better, Caboose. I'm debating what is in our final report and trying to match that up with what we have in the bylaws. Matthew, there's no further comments on that. I can quickly come to the third one on question four.
We have Sebastian first. Sebastian.
Yes, sorry. Thank you, Mathieu, and thank you, Steve. Yeah, just to be short, I think as as much as we can leave outside of the bylaw very defined things, too much definition or too much detail, it's good. And you can just think that I agree with the fact that we produce an operating document because it was my proposal since the beginning, and it will not new for you about my position, but I think it will be easier to have lighter bylaw and to have something else to deal with those type of discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. So your last point, Steve. Then we'll
thank you. So this is the third and final point, because it's the third time in the draft bylaws that the phrase operating standards was referred to in the discussion of the affirmation of commitments reviews. And that is in section 46A4. And it relates to how the review teams can consider independent expert advice. And the bylaws on that suggest that operating standards will determine that. But our final approved report said, quote, the review team may choose to accept or reject all or part of the independent advice. And that's in paragraph 60, annex 9. So in our report, we said that the review team could choose to accept or reject all or part of the advice. And the bylaws are silent on that, either leaving it to the review team or assuming that the community would come up with an operating standard about how to deal with that. This hasn't been a significant problem with the AOC reviews that have happened so far, and I believe that it's acceptable to let that fall to the operating standards and not necessarily be in the bylaw. Matthew, any discussion of that?
Thank you, Steve. I see Alan's hand is up.
Yeah, thank you. I only have one minor concern. If the bylaws are referring to operating standards and they have not been written, does that fall back to the group simply makes a decision, or are they in violation? Are we in violation of our bylaws by not having operating standards?
Okay, that's a point we'll take to the lawyers, I guess.
Right, and I'll just quote Alan. It says in the draft bylaws that operating standards will be developed with the global internet community for the conduct of reviews under this section, and it requires that they be aligned with guidelines. So the bylaws indicate that they will be developed. I'm unaware of whether they're complete, although we were told by staff last fall that operating standards were in development, but we're not yet ready for circulation. And if anyone on ICANN board or management can give us a better indication of where the state of those operating standards is today.
Okay, so let's not do that now, but certainly note the question from Alan to make sure we don't get into a deadlock here. I think question five, on this question, we'll circulate the thoughts that you have developed, Steve, as our draft. And on question five, which is on the SSR review, I think it's more of a detail, so maybe you can summarize it quickly and provide your recommendation, Steve.
Happy to. The lawyers in drafting this bylaw for the Security, Stability, and Resiliency Review, we'll just call it the SSR review. It's one of the four reviews required in the affirmation. And they note that we did not in our final report, we dropped one sentence from the commitment part. And without that sentence in there, they wonder whether the rest of the section actually makes sense. Okay, so I'll tell you the sentence we dropped. It's in Annex 9 of the final report. We included everything from the SSR review except for this sentence. Quote, ICANN has developed a plan to enhance the operational stability, reliability, resiliency, security, and global interoperability of the DNS, which will be regularly updated by ICANN to reflect emerging threats to the DS. So that was a declarative statement in the affirmation that ICANN has developed a plan for SSR and a promise to say that it will be regularly updated by ICANN. And so we did not include that as a new commitment in the bylaws, since I don't know whether there is an existing SSR plan. So my suggestion, Matthew, is to quickly ask ICANN management, particularly security, stability, and resiliency teams, to tell us what document that is. Give us a formal reference to how to refer to that document so we can reference it in this part of the review, and therefore the rest of the concerns raised in question five will be addressed. So all we need to do is to reference that plan specifically. I think the lawyers made a good catch on this one. But I didn't want to just put in the verbatim language of the affirmation because it vaguely refers to developing a plan. That's all I got on that one. I think this one will be easy to solve.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Cavus?
Yes, I don't agree to replace plan with efforts. Effort is voluntary in nature, almost, but not 100%. But plan could be something like security measures. So it is more a stronger word, and we have difficulty to replace that by efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, can we take that into account?
Cavus, the suggestion I just made agrees with you. I suggested that we find out what management describes as their plan and reference the plan.
Okay. Excellent. So I think we're good to go on five with your suggestion to reach out to ICANN on that. Question number six is about is getting on the section regarding the board, the ICANN board. Basically, there's the draft bylaws are keeping the option for the board to remove directors without cause, which is an option that exists currently, and there's a question which is that considering that our proposal does not clarify how the board could obtain the consent of the empowered community, there's a few suggestions about how to achieve that. And Alan Greenberg raised that question as well in one of his emails. I think there's a need for us to make sure we understand why there's a need for the consent of the empowered community first, because that was not part of the report. And Alan's speculation was that it was due to the fact that we have a designator model. I wonder if we could have some confirmation on the reason why there's the consent of the empowered community here from Rosemary first, and then get into the discussion. Rosemary?
Yes, Alan is exactly right. Once directors have been designated, then removal by the board is only permitted with the consent of that designator.
Okay, so that's something we had overlooked in our proposal then. And the proposals provide the empowered community the opportunity to oppose the removal using the escalation process and the thresholds for the standard bylaws rejection process. So that would be an escalation process.
May I speak to this recommendation briefly?
Sure.
Our thought was that if 75% of the board, which is a fairly high standard, is finding a particular director appointed either, you know, named originally by either the nominating committee or one of the SOs or ACs so problematic from some perspective that they would like to stop working with that person because they're finding perhaps that the board meetings aren't going well or, you know, it's not workable, that is something that in general, as a matter of good governance, ought to be respected. So we chose the suggestion of looking at the same escalation process as is used for standard bylaws rejection, because that's the one that says, you know, the board's picked a bylaw, and unless we really hate it and can organize to oppose it, we will live with the board's decision. We felt that that was probably the closest existing standard, and we didn't want to be creating, or process, I should say, and we didn't want to be creating whole new processes. And the only difference that would result between the way the escalation process works for standard bylaws and the way the escalation process would work for consenting to a board removal of a director is the last step, the number three there where it says if they do not oppose, there has to be a certification because we actually do need the designator's consent.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. I think that lays out the question quite well. We have quite a few. I would encourage people to be brief about indicating either support or their concern with the proposed way forward. Brett?
Thank you, Matthew. I don't have an issue with going through the existing processes in terms of exercise of the community powers to derive the EC consent on this matter, but I think we need to reverse that and go away from the rejection model to go toward the affirmative action model. Both would involve a three SOAC threshold, but I think you would get consent through an affirmative action and you would get rejection, not get consent through a rejection, because that would imply, it would sort of reverse the standard here, because it would set up a situation where it wouldn't be three-quarters vote of the board and the consent of the EC. It would be three-quarters vote of the board and a lack of opposition from the EC in order to block this. And so if you're looking for consent, I think you got to go for affirmative action. Thank you.
Brett, I think you're extending the requirement beyond what our lawyers are actually seeing as feasible. So I'm not sure this is strictly a requirement. So which leaves us with a question of opportunity.
But it is a requirement, they said, because the designator must approve the removal.
Yes, but they're suggesting this process. And if I understand that if Rosemary is suggesting this process, it's because the lawyer's assessment is that this process is consistent with the California Code.
I'm not saying it's necessarily inconsistent. I'm saying it gives the board much more leeway in terms of removing a board member than would otherwise be the case. You're looking for consent of
our report says
board members. And there's also a process here. A question is, if a SOAC, an individual SOAC, is appointing an individual board member, and that board member is the target of a board dismissal, and that SOAC can solely decide to remove or appoint them, how much say should they have in that process as well in terms of this? Could they then just reappoint the same member after the board votes three-quarters to dismiss them? I mean, I think in terms of a process and in terms of respecting the community's input here, having the community affirmatively say they support the dismissal is far less controversial or one to result in confrontation between the board and the EC than the opposite. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. Adam?
Thank you very much. Clearly, it's somewhat unfortunate that we weren't aware of this requirement ahead of time. My first inclination was to say we should use the same process as we use for fundamental bylaws, which essentially is the same situation, that the board takes action and it has to be confirmed by the empowered community. However, both of these processes, both the one proposed and the one I just suggested, I find somewhat troublesome. If the board is actually taking action to remove a director, I think it's important that director cease to be active immediately and not still be there during the what will effectively be weeks of time for either the community to decide they're not opposing it and certify that they're not, or to support it and certify that they are supporting it. So either way, I find that somewhat troublesome. So I guess I'd like to hear from the lawyers. Is there a mechanism by which that person can essentially be off the board pending the community taking action? And at that point, I'm not particularly concerned which direction it's taken in. As per what Brett said, clearly, since no single AC or SO can veto, the board could remove an AC or SO director, and that AC and SO could not stop it. They could reappoint them, but they couldn't stop it. And I'm not unhappy with that, but I really would want to find out, is there a way we can do it such that the director is removed effectively immediately and we're not dragging out for weeks or months while the community takes action or decides not to take action? Thank you.
Alan, just noting that you had an answer that it's apparently not possible from Holly in the chat from a legal perspective.
Sorry, your voice is mangled, Matthew. I don't know what you just said.
Okay, so just check the chat where Holly said it's not possible from a legal perspective.
Ah.
Which is general governance. You don't dismiss a board member just like this. Caruso, and I'm closing the queue after Rosemary. Caruso. Caruso, if you're speaking, I cannot hear you.
Do you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, the issue is that the board removing the director or the staff remove director with the threshold and consent of the designating community. Why not we take the same text when the community remove the director? The final decision will be within the nominating constituency, but invite comments from other constituencies. So the text is mentioned in the reverse side, invites and consider comments from the SO and AC, and then the majority within the 3-4 majority within the nominating communities. So why not in this case also we seek comments from other SO and AC, however the final decision and consent remains within the designating community. So why not we take the same text? Thank you.
Thank you for your suggestion, Caruso. Jordan?
Hi, everyone. Jordan Carter here. Good morning from Wellington. I have a different view on this one. I don't think there's any mandate from our report to do anything to the board's power to remove a director. And so I don't think it would be proper for us to impose the escalation process in any way. I think this is much more like the fact that, legally speaking, the designator needs to approve the removal. But practically speaking, as with the appointment process for the SOs and ALAC, it should be an automatic action. In other words, we shouldn't be seeking to tie down and restrain the board's ability to use this power, because we've got no mandate to do that from the proposal that was approved on the 10th of March. If we do have that mandate, I can't remember it being in the report at any of our draft stages. So I would much prefer there to be a kind of automatic valid process so that there isn't a decision, there isn't an escalation process, there aren't weeks of delays. We have lots of remedies if the board fires a director that the community didn't want fired. Altering this process without a mandate shouldn't be one of them. Thanks.
Thank you, Jordan. Greg?
Thanks. Greg Shatton for the record. First, I'll agree with Jordan, and then I think, you know, beyond that, at most it should be the other way around, that, you know, perhaps the empowered community should have the power to overrule the board removal, at least a board removal without cause for a board member, where we're talking about board removal with cause, which I see Steve Crocker posted a couple of things in the chat that I would consider to be with cause, for instance, and I think these may actually be in the current bylaws, taking, you know, just sheer absenteeism or violations of confidentiality or conflicts of interest or things like that. I think that the EC is out of bounds in having a role in that kind of a removal. And I think we need to be careful generally from kind of introducing new matter into our work at this point. It's one thing to clarify our decisions, another thing to start extrapolating, which we should avoid. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I'm seeing people adding themselves into the queue again, would ask them whether...
Sean, the queue.
Okay, Sean, I had closed the queue already, we'll certainly circulate something for the list on that topic. I'd like to hear Rosemary probably can give us insights about the legal feasibility of the various options. Rosemary?
Yes, very briefly. I think this is really not a legal decision that you need to make. It can be done largely along the ways Jordan has suggested, not quite the way Alan described it in the chat, but essentially that the Empowered community would have an obligation in the bylaws upon notice that the board has voted by the required level to remove a director without cause to consent. We could draft that in, I think, legally, given the flexibility we have with the unincorporated association governance form. We could also use the standard bylaws approach, which would give the community a chance to object if they really felt strongly and mustered the level required, or we could go all the way to actually requiring a full escalation and consent in the same way that we do for fundamental bylaws changes. So really, all three options can be done legally. We just need your direction.
Thank you, Rosemary. And certainly, I think the point for us is what is closest to our existing report. We should introduce as little new requirements or powers or phases as possible at this point of the process. Alan, I understand you're insisting on a last word before I conclude.
No, I'm not insisting. I would like to see what Rosemary said in the chat or something, because as words fly by when I'm listening, I don't always capture the full substance of what it is. So I would like to see that in some level, either now or immediately after the meeting. I suspect one of her options is quite acceptable.
Thank you, Alan. And indeed, what we'll do is elaborate a little bit on what I've called the Jordan option, the Jordan approach, because my impression is that this is the closest from the requirements of our report. Elaborate on that and include that as a draft answer to the question, so that everyone can consider it in the meantime with the next meeting. And with that, we are going to make a big leap in the document, because the next questions are for the CWG. And so follow me, if you will, until question number 25. Or have I missed 7? Where's 7? Oh, I've missed 7, sorry. I was too optimistic. We need to go back to 7. 7 is about the interim board. And our proposal was silent on how the interim board would consult with the community to make major decisions. And the suggestion from the legal teams is that the interim board shall A, consult with the chairs of the SOACs, B, consult through a community forum in a manner consistent with our community forums prior to taking actions. And the question is whether these processes are the right ones. I don't know, Jordan, if you would, as a rapporteur for Work Party 1, would you like to share what your thoughts are about the relevance of this in the context of our report?
Sure, Matthew. Hi, it's Jordan here again. This isn't something I think that we gave a great deal of thought to, the approach of using the SOAC leadership as a sounding board there makes sense to me. It's a known group of people. There are existing methods for the board and the executive to reach out to that group of people. And if something comes through there that's going to cause concern, those people are at the head of organizations that can easily be notified and mobilized to deal with any concerns. So I think it's a nice, simple, pragmatic way to go.
Thanks, Jordan. Greg? Or is it an old hand, Greg?
Thanks. It's either an old hand or I'll pass.
Okay. I'll take a pass for an answer. Sébastien.
Yes, thank you, Mathieu. Sébastien Bachelet speaking. I think we need to try to find as much as possible a way not to couple decision from one body and asking the body what is they are thinking about. We must be confident that we put an interim board. If they need to have a very early decision because it's an interim board, if they need to go through a discussion with everybody, will be already dead, but this time it will be the end. And I suggest not to have those rules. We the community, choose the interim board, and we need to trust them. If not, all the process is going wrong. And the second point, if we decide to have discussion, is it with the chair of the SOAC or is it with the Emperor Community Council? I'll read somewhere that there is a EC Council that maybe it could be the best way if we need absolutely to have some discussion. Thank you.
So I don't think the EC Council is a good approach because it's supposed to be an administrative type of body that just collects and rubber stamps decisions in the construct of the report. But I take your point about not imposing too many rules. I think we need to be conscious of that. Cavus?
Matthew, does paragraph 98 not discussing this issue? It mentioned that the ICANN bylaw will state that they accept in the circumstances where the urgent decisions are needed to protect the security, stability, and resilience of the DNS, the interim board will consult with the community through the SONAC. Is it not the case? Yeah. Paragraph 98.
Case settled. Case settled. You know the report much better than me, Cavus. So
yes, that is 98 explaining that.
Excellent.
But all this question is, Matthew, it's Jordan, sorry to interrupt. All this question is about how that is done. So all this is asking for clarification is how that requirement to consult is actually achieved. And the lawyers have made that concrete suggestion, chairs of SOs and ACs. To me, that makes sense. It's consistent with our report. It's nice and simple.
Excellent. Thank you. Alan?
I can accept silence and trust that the interim board that we put in place will do something reasonable. I can accept saying it's the chairs of the ACs and SOs. Complex than that, I would object to very strenuously. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, so we seem to have a way forward on how to answer positively about the processes that need to be lightweight on question 7. So now we are moving to question number 25. Which is a very interesting one because it's related to the our well-famous carve-out. The question is that there's a requirement to describe how a petition in the empowered community process can be identified as based on GAC advice. And there was a discussion about whether the word solely was sufficient, and that's maybe in some cases quite difficult to assess. So I know, Steve, you gave some thought about this question, and maybe you can share your understanding of the issue as well as a proposed way forward with the group. Steve?
Thanks, Matthew. It's Steve Del Bianco, and I discussed this today with Matthew Shears, who's also on the call. And we agree with the legal team by saying that the words almost solely is a bit unfamiliar to speakers of English, let alone those for whom it's a second or third language. I think that the concept makes sense. In that GAC advice, there are going to be instances where the GAC
advice will not be solely based on or entirely based on the GAC's input by the time ICANN's management makes a decision. It could be acting on a budget item for a particular piece of GAC advice, but GAC advice that may have been supported by another AC or an SO. In which case, is it solely at that point acting on GAC advice? Well, maybe not. So there need to be some shade of gray there for what is acting on GAC advice. So just parsing the words, solely or almost solely, was very difficult. So the recommendation Matthew Shears and I have is to use the words entirely or almost entirely. Entirely or almost entirely. It's just an easier way to understand the concept. If it preserves the need for a shade of gray, in that if you just said entirely on GAC advice, what happens if the GAC advice isn't the only means by which ICANN decided to take an action? And then we would not be able to invoke the carve-out. So the idea there is to preserve the carve-out when we need it, when something is clearly either entirely based on a GAC advice or almost entirely. And I propose that's how we address that. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you, Steve. Next is Malcolm.
Thank you. I'd like to stand the case.
Noted, Shane. Malcolm.
There are actually a range of common terms that are used in these situations, primarily as one. Substantially is another, significantly would be another, that would give you a range of weight. I would be concerned about using any language which limited it so tightly to this that actually the recommendation was not given effect because, for example, the board conducted a public comment and also took into account the results of the public comments, as well as the GAC advice before formulating its policy, and then said, oh, it's not based solely on the GAC advice, it's also based on the public comment feedback. That really undermined the effect of the recommendation that we've given. So I would suggest something less than solely or almost entirely, but significantly or substantially or primarily or materially. As options to be considered.
Thank you, Malcolm.
That's a little weaker than what Steve just said.
Thank you, Malcolm. Next is Caboose.
Matthew, I'm sorry, I don't understand the discussions, and I would like that somebody clearly explain what is the difficulty, what is the problem between the two people in the drafting team that they do not agree with each other and be creating some of the words solely, entirely, significantly, remarkably, and so on and so forth. All of this adjective I don't agree because it relates to a very, very sensitive issue. Please kindly clarify what we are talking, what is the problems, what is the discussions. Thank you.
Steve, would you like to attempt to respond to Caboose's question, please?
Caboose, this is Steve. It's not a disagreement among members of the drafting team, nor even among members of the CCWG. It's trying to find the right words to know when the carve-out is appropriately exercised. And we talked about our draft report said that the carve-out is there when the board is acting on GAC advice, GAC consensus advice, that action or inaction of the board, if challenged by the community, would invoke the carve-out for the GAC. So the question is, how do we define in the bylaws, where language is more precise, how do we define acting on GAC advice? And the lawyers in their all-nighters were looking at ways of saying, is it mean entirely upon GAC advice, solely on GAC advice, substantially, and they're trying to find the right word, and we are trying to help find the right word that we can all understand so that it cannot be gamed in such a way that the mere posting for public comment, the mere indication of one other entity supporting a particular action means that it's not based on GAC advice anymore. On the other hand, if the GAC advice came in and the entire community supported it, then that wouldn't seem to me entirely based on GAC advice. So we're trying to find the right words, and it is an appropriate conversation at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Anand?
Thank you. The kinds of things that worry me are if the GAC gives advice, but the ALAC also gives similar advice, and that's number one. Or number two, the situation is the GAC raises something and the board says, gee, we never thought of that before. That's really true. They're no longer deciding it based on the GAC advice, simply the fact that the GAC raised it. I think it all comes down to what the rationale is that the board uses to justify its action. And, you know, I think, you know, the words largely like, but it's going to be a subjective call at that point because it's got to be geared off of what is the rationale for taking the action. I'm not sure how we can have a black and white situation that doesn't require a judgment call by somebody at that point. At least I don't know. I don't see how. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Rosemary.
Yeah, I think actually it's a Alan's point was a good segue into what I'd like to say, which is that I want to be clear that there are two different steps to this process and we shouldn't conflate them. The first one is that the board has to determine when its decision, when it makes a decision that is essentially following or consistent with GAC consensus advice. The bylaws draft says that the board has to determine whether the GAC advice was a material basis, and that's not the exact words we use, but a material basis for the board's decision. And if so, the board labels that decision a decision based on GAC consensus advice potentially triggering the carve-out. So the first step is that the board thinks, and I think that's exactly what Alan was saying, the board has to think about, because yes, sometimes there's going to be five different groups all giving the same advice. Was it really because the GAC gave it that you did it or not? So it can't just be that you happen to follow GAC advice. And we felt that the best we could do was impose on the board a materiality, decide what was material to your decision. Once the board does that and labels, then we get to the second step. Now we have somebody objecting. And the concern we had here is that GAC advice, let's take the budget. GAC advice might have been followed on one piece of the budget, but not the whole rest of the budget, if the GAC advice concerned only a piece. And that's where we got into this idea that the person complaining about the board decision based on GAC advice has an obligation, is in a position to frame the scope of their objection. And they have to tailor it to be basically about the GAC consensus advice issue. And the idea of having a little bit of wiggle room was that there might be some issues where it's virtually impossible to tailor it to only address the GAC advice because the issue is so intertwined with something else that you couldn't frame it that way, and we didn't want people to be prevented from framing a complaint. Then, if they have a broader complaint, that's where you get into this bifurcated, maybe there are two rejection processes proceeding at the same time, one of which is solely or, you know, this terrible wording we had, almost solely, related to the GAC advice piece, that the board has identified that the GAC consensus advice was material to their decision. Or if it's not, doesn't meet that standard, then you have a separate rejection that would not have the GAC carve out. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Rosemary. Cavus, Jorge, and then we'll close this discussion for now.
Yes, Matthew, I am very, very sensitive to all these discussions. People, they describe being many things, all of them right. Alan says that maybe GAC advice plus ALAC advice. So we should treat them individually. GAC advice means the advice coming from GAC only, not from the others. So we just treat that one, and the carve-out relates to the GAC advice. And that is only if you want to talk about strictly or exclusively and so on and so forth. So I don't think that we should mix up the situation. The carve-out is that if there is a GAC advice and this GAC advice is not in line with the bylaw, board would not accept that. If it is in line with the bylaw, the board accept that, then the community will object to that, and that is another process. So we should treat GAC advice entirely and different from any other mixture of any other advice. Because that is the whole thing that I send you a long message of today. The people and the lawyers, they mix up the GAC carve out totally. And that is the subject of my email. I put it in color and I explain why it is mixed up. There are total misunderstanding of the carve out created by some colleagues. And so on. So we do not agree to mix up the situation, and it is very, very critical. So we should just treat GAC advice, whether is it for some part of the budget is GAC advice. We don't say this advice on the budget, little bit of the budget. What does it mean, little bit of budget? GAC advice talking of something, and that advice should be treated as GAC advice. If there is ALAC advice, that is another issue. I don't think that should be mixed up with the GAC advice. The two different things, and the board should treat them separately. So I cannot agree with any text unless we have a clear understanding of what is the carve-out is. And properly is not reflected in the bylaw, as I see in the section Article 3, in Section 3.3, and in Section 3F, Roman 1 and Roman 2. Totally mixed up, and I am confused with all of these things because people misunderstand everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. Jorge, and then I'll do my best to summarize. Jorge.
Hello, good evening. Do you hear me?
Yes. Yes, very well, Jorge.
Hello, Jorge Gancia, Twitter and GAC, Switzerland, for the record. I said the question is trying to address the situation where a board decision is based on different inputs from the community, one of them being the GAC input. So in that situation, I think that we need a rule of conflict, so to say, to make sure that the carve out is not overbroad and does not act also as a disincentive for the GAC to engage into community dialogue with other SOs and ACs. So perhaps the I wasn't a proposer of the carve out rule. But I guess that the object or the finality of this carve-out was to exclude the GAC from decisions of the board being challenged by the community when those decisions are based distinctively on something only the GAC said and not something which could have been shared by other parts of the community. So perhaps there should be an element to reflect this thought that the carve-out and the exclusion only applies where there is this distinctive element, so this distinctive basis on a GAC advice, on a GAC consensus advice, and this GAC consensus advice is clearly differentiated or unique vis-a-vis the inputs given by other SOs and ACs. And this would be my take of the issue. And also a question to the lawyers, because this has never been very clear to me. If there's a conflict of interpretation on these rules, who gets to decide in the end on the interpretation of here or almost solely
or distinctively or whatever we include in the bylaws on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Jorge. Actually, before summarizing, I need to go to Sean. That I'm sorry, Sean, I overlooked your place in the queue. So you have the floor, Sean.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Yeah, so I don't know. I lost audio. I don't know what stage you are on the discussion. I'd like to comment on the options that Steve was presenting in relation to the carve-outs. I think I really have no... I don't know what is informing the option. I think it should be straightforward. The proposal was about the carve-out was about board action on GAC consensus advice. There's nothing like almost entirely. There's nothing like close to it. It either is GAC advice or not. If there is a public comment, where GAC made its own consensus advice towards the public comment, and where other SOs of AC also did the same, that is not entirely GAC advice. It's the community that is speaking at that point in time, and the carve-out should not be applicable in that situation. I think the proposal was straightforward, and I don't think we need to stress this process unnecessarily at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. I think your point is clearly heightened, adding to the discussion, which shows that we have a range of options, a range of words available. There's a diversity of views as well. Raising issues about appeals that Rosemary is attempting to actually address in the chat, so there's need for further work on that one. Certainly, it's a complex one that we need to provide a draft approach to before the next meeting. But I don't feel we're in a position to actually conclude on that one. So thanks to the legal team for raising this. That's going to be an interesting one. 26 would be maybe a quick win. Maybe we can be fast on 26. The question number 26 is a suggestion to increase transparency by adding a requirement for the decisional participants supporting a petition to give notice. With some language proposed. I think it goes in the right direction. There's no harm in adding transparency into the decisional participants by notifying to the various stakeholders. So I think we could go for approving this one fast, unless there's an objection on the 26th. Which once again only adds a little bit of transparency to the decisions of the decisional participants. And seeing no hand up, that's going to be our interim position. And I now have the pleasure to hand over to Thomas for the remaining how many questions, Thomas?
Yeah, it's a couple of questions. Let's try to be brief and get as much covered as we can before the top of the hour. Looking at question number 27 now, there is the possibility that a PDP requires a change of bylaws. That can be fundamental bylaws as well. So the question was whether that should follow the standard for standard bylaws or for fundamental bylaws. We think, having prepared this, that if changes to fundamental bylaws are required, these changes should be following the procedure for changing fundamental bylaws. Otherwise, our requirement for fundamental bylaws would be diluted. So unless there's opposition to this in the chat or hands are raised, I would suggest that this will be our response to the legal team. Then question number 28. Oh, Jordan's hand is up. Jordan?
Just really quickly, Thomas, to clarify that you would use the fundamental bylaws change process, but the SO that did the PVP would have to agree. So they would still retain the protection of their PDP while we were still following the process.
Correct. And I guess that's something that we had in our report already, so that wouldn't be a change or a clarification to the report. Thanks to you, John, for adding that. Let's now briefly look at 28.
Sorry, no, Thomas, on that last.
Malcolm?
Does the report require us to say to remove the right of the SOAC to object to the bylaws change? Because clearly the final report must have primacy in this, but if this is being introduced anew, I think it's highly questionable. It may well be that the PDP gave rise to the bylaws change, but has been implemented in a way that the SOAC does not support and would wish to object to it, doesn't agree with the way the board has done it, doesn't believe that the change that is being made needs to be done, even though maybe some change needs to be done. So I don't see that requiring the SOAC to support that bylaws change is at all appropriate.
Malcolm, it's Jordan here. Just to clarify, that's the whole point. So if the SO doesn't approve the change, it can't happen.
All right. Thank you for the clarification. I remove my objection.
And again, that's not a deviation from our report because that's exactly what we had in our report. I'm afraid we have to end this exercise. Now we have 2 minutes to the top of the hour, now 1 minute to the top of the hour, and Alan has mentioned that he has an AOB as well as Cavus. So Cavus will go first, and then we will hear from Alan.
Thomas, I think we, member of the CCWG, has worked together for 14 months in a way to collaborate with each other in a professional manner. Some, not all, GAC members were very disappointed, frustrated, and even was over angry of the statement of one of the person who made testimony before the subcommittee of the House. And in many areas, GAC was the aim of the testimony, and in one of the items among 7 or 8, it is mentioned the following. While reducing GAC influence through several measures, it is clearly a net gain for ICANN private sector stakeholders. When a particular constituency have a net gain, means that the other constituency have a net loss. I don't think that was an objective of the entire group. That created considerable difficulty in the GAC. A lot of email was exchanged. Some people, they thought this is totally offensive to the GAC. Some people wanted to react. So I am very, very sorry to hear some sort of these things to perhaps make the subcommittee happy to what has happened and saying that, okay, very good, you have done a good job. Now the GAC influence has been reduced to the minimum, almost zero, and the private sector has a net gain. Does we really talking of gaining and losing something, or we are saying that win-win or equal basis and so on and so forth? So what this statement is about? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. I think Steve Delbianco would like to respond to that, and then we will move to Alan.
Thank you. This will be quick. Cavus, you know very well that I am the strongest defender of making sure the GAC is part of the empowered community, the decisional role that many others object to. I want you to understand something. I was asked by the committee's chair to to respond to a statement by another witness that was submitted, and their statement called upon the U.S. Commerce Department to extend the IANA contract by 2 years because the proposal, quote, would greatly enhance the power of governments within ICANN relative to the status quo, unquote. So my response to that statement was what you would expect it to be. I suggested that adding GAC to the empowered community is appropriate, and I explained why, and went on to say that GAC consensus advice has been constrained significantly in the sense that only true consensus would enjoy the special treatment, even though we have increased the threshold for board rejection of GAC advice. But on balance, I believe we did not increase government's power at ICANN. And I had to make that statement to rebut the statement that GAC's power had increased. So those contexts should be appropriate for you to understand that I was asked to respond to a statement that claimed that government's got too much power and that the entire transition be extended by 2 years. So I hope that helps you understand a little more of the context.
No, it does not. You said a net gain for the private sector. You consider that you gain. You consider that GAC was lower down. I don't use another word. So that is your statement, says that a net gain for the private sector. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose, and thanks, Steve. I think we need to end this discussion. We're 3 minutes beyond the top of the hour. Let's hear Ellen now.
Thank you very much. When I raised in the email, when I raised the issue regarding question number 6, and I pointed out that it wasn't just that we hadn't specified how the community would support it, but we hadn't specified that the community would even have to support it, I asked for the legal team or whoever to identify any other changes they have made to our proposal, which were simply put in, perhaps because a matter of necessity, but were put in. This one came up as one of the questions because they had a quandary of how to implement it. But I would really like to make sure that if we have anything else that was put in, that it be highlighted explicitly, we not have to find them ourselves. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. Sebastian, you've raised your hand. If you could please keep it brief.
Thank you, Tamai. And yes, I will. Just to say that the document we received seems missing in the table of contents annex E, F, and G. And I would like to suggest that as the change of numbering from Roman to Arab number was a good move, that we use 1 and 1.1 and 1.1.1 and so on and so forth. Like that, when you quote one part of the document, it's easier than the today where you have to say it's in the 1AH or whatever. For purposes of discussion of a point, it will be better. If it can be done, it will be great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sebastian. I would leave that to the drafting team that has heard your comment. Before we end the call, let me briefly announced that in order to get our answers to the drafting team as quickly as possible, we will offer suggestions for questions on the remaining questions until question number 34 on the list tomorrow for you to be able to comment on, and then hopefully save some time during the next call to get those answers finalized. Also, we would like to encourage you to send to the list issues that you have identified. We need to discuss or issues where you think that the draft falls short of what we have in our report, so that we can then try to offer responses to you or, as the case may be, pass the request on to the legal drafting teams. So with that, we would like to thank all of you for your participation in this call and for your contributions. We will continue the conversation on the list and reconvene on Thursday. Thanks, everyone, and bye for today.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.